Hello, welcome back to another episode. So today we'll be continuing our discussion about Aristotle's four causes, efficient, material, final, and formal cause, and how McLuhan retrieved formal cause to use for his own theories about how history moves. We left off talking about T.S. Eliot and his famous essay, Tradition and the Individual Talent. And that discussion can be connected to another probe of the McLuhans, another probe involving formal cause. They make the case that the formal cause is the audience, using examples like advertising and various forms of art. It's related to Thomas Aquinas' view of formal cause, and remember, McLuhan is a big fan of Thomas Aquinas. He calls himself a Thomist. Aquinas says that form is necessary for defining something. Like, let's do a stupid example. Let's say you have a friend, and they really wanted to get into woodwork, making things out of wood. So they hammer and sand and glue and varnish away. They do all the woodworking stuff, and then they call you into their backyard. Excited, they show you what they made. Unfortunately, you can't tell what the hell it is or what it was supposed to be. To you, it's just like a messy jumble of wood and nails. Like, the whole might be even less than the sum of its parts. That's how shitty it is. A horrific nightmare, a terrible attempt at making something, who knows what. So the friend tries again, and with their added bit of experience, they're able to make something that's a little bit more refined or defined. They bring you into the yard again, and you see, again, very shoddy woodwork, but you take a closer look, and you see that at about knee height, the wooden structure has a flat platform. And then you see behind that flat platform are nearly vertical boards, but at a bit of a slant. So you turn to your friend, and you're like, is that a chair? And he's like, yeah, it is. And he's excited that you know what it is. So Aquinas says that form is a cause because form allows us to tell what a thing is. After the friend's first attempt, there wasn't a chair because there was no form of a chair. Once it acquires that form, it becomes a chair. And before we continue talking about this, I should mention, I think part of what makes formal causality confusing, especially with the McLuhans and their probes and all that, is the variety of ways to talk about it and the variety of situations where it applies. And perhaps the biggest one is whether a conscious agent is involved. Like, that's one of the tricky things about understanding Aristotle, because he wrote about causes in nature, but within a culture that wasn't secular and believed in like deities and stuff. So a confusion I've seen pop up is whether formal cause needs a mind to perceive it or an agent to conceive it. We're going to look at formal cause without a consciousness later, formal cause as it's found in nature, for example. But for now, let's focus on formal cause where a human mind is involved. So that's, we're narrowing it a little bit when we're talking about the chair example here. And let's split the making of the chair into Aristotle's four causes. The material cause is wood and a few other things like nails, right? Everything the chair is made out of. The friend building it is the efficient cause, who, by his actions on the material, eventually makes an object to sit on, the final cause. So where does formal cause enter this picture? An interesting question is, how does a friend know when he's made a chair? How does he determine when the task has been completed? I mean, in the example, he failed the first time, but that was a bit of a silly example, since most people wouldn't say they're finished until the finished product was a recognizable chair, right? But the example pointed out something else. Other people have to know it's a chair as well. So maybe we can say that the concept of a chair needs to exist first, before that individual chair. What a chair is preceded that individual chair. However, what the chair is can't be separated from the chair. The chair is a chair. You can't just take chairness away from it and put it over there. But still, this thing, this chairness, this essence of chairs, existed before the friend even thought about building a chair. Like, you couldn't think to build a chair without this concept of a chair, the form of a chair. Isn't that interesting? Hopefully that's not too confusing. We're gonna unravel this some more. And you know, maybe this is why McLuhan thinks that formal cause contains both being and becoming, both chairness and the individual chair, the ground, chairness, and the figure, the individual chair. We perceive the chair this friend built, but there's something else that makes us perceive the chair as a chair. And what makes us perceive the chair as a chair is hidden. It's not something people usually think about or are even aware of, unless you're some sort of weird philosopher or listening to weird podcasts. But it's the active process that makes the thing to us. There's this weird thing, though, in McLuhan's understanding of formal cause. And again, it might be because of the probes and all that, but it seems like the formal cause is both the perception of the figure, the chair in this example, but also the interplay between the figure and ground, between chair and chairness. Yoni van den Eede says, quote, "Formal cause is thus the result and, at the same time, the ground of the result," unquote. Corey Anton, or I should mention, all these names I'm going to drop, these are all McLuhan scholars, unless I mention otherwise. Corey Anton defines formal cause as, quote, "what allows something to be what it is, and also to be recognized as the thing that it is," unquote. Obviously, we can understand that with the chair example, right? Like, the chair couldn't have been a chair without chairness, but also, people couldn't have recognized it as a chair without chairness, this essence of chair. Formal cause is what allows something to be what it is, and also to be recognized as the thing that it is. The chair example relates to a deep question in philosophy, going back to the Greeks, and, you know, probably in the other philosophical traditions that I know even less about. The relationship between being, non-being, and becoming. We're going to talk about this, contextualize McLuhan's formal cause in the history of Western philosophy, and talk about a notable philosopher who's building upon McLuhan. But first, there's an example from contemporary media that really highlights formal cause and the importance of recognizing formal cause. I'm talking about memes. And this will talk about formal cause in relation to the internet better than any ramblings in the last episode, I think. But first, let's jump back a century and a bit to Adolf Hildebrand, the late 19th, early 20th century sculptor and art theorist, who divided the form of a piece of art into two, perceptual and actual. So perceptual form and actual form. Perceptual form is how the art appears to the senses. And actual form is, you know, its actual form, pretty self-explanatory, how it is in reality. And the actual form can only be deduced from how it appears, perceptual form. Hildebrand said that, quote, "in true art, the actual form has its reality only as an effect," unquote. So think back to last episode and how the McLuhans were playing around with cause and effect and saying that with formal cause, the effects precede the causes and all that other weird stuff, right? Here's an example of Hildebrand, somebody who influenced the McLuhans, saying that in true art, the actual form has its reality only as an effect, which is, you know, kind of similar to that reversal of cause and effect. The actual form is something that happens after the fact, after you perceive it. And also think back to McLuhan's idea that the user is the content of technology, and that the meaning of technology arises from the interplay between the technology and the user. The meaning of meaning is relationship. Eric McLuhan says that poems, for example, aren't just a passive object. If you only regard a poem as a set of static symbols, written words as object, you don't understand the most important parts of the poem. If a poem just appeared magically one day in the middle of a desert carved on a rock that was never read by anyone, it would be, in a way, far less of a poem than one that has been read, right? He says that poems are, quote, "active processes that complete or achieve their forms by interacting with audiences. The reader is the formal cause of the poem, and the audience is the formal cause of the advertisement, sculpture, song, or sofa, and the consumer, the formal cause of the consumer product," unquote. So just like chairness is necessary for the chair to be a chair, poemness is necessary for the poem to be a poem. And poemness must reside within the minds of the people who read the poem, the people in interplay with the poem. The poet needs poemness to create a poem, and the audience needs poemness to receive a poem. But interestingly, I think there's more going on when it comes to, like, art than, like, a chair. To the McLuhans, the idea that function precedes form is mechanical, modernist, typographical logic. So that might, I should explain that. Function preceding form. So that's like in the chair example. Some guy's like, I want a thing to sit on, and then they create the form of a chair, right? Function of sitting preceded the form of a chair. But I don't know if most poets sit down like, I am going to write a poem about plums in an ice box, and then they write a poem about plums in an ice box. Like, what I think happens is something less mechanical, right? Like, form can precede function, form and function can emerge together as the poet scribbles and crosses out and writes in the margin and all that stuff. And also, life experiences happen, and poems can be written over months too. It doesn't have to be created just in one moment either. There's definitely more to dig into with like poems and art and stuff and how it relates to formal cause. I'm still a little fuzzy on that. At the end of the creation, you have a poem and that poem has a form. I think that's, for now, that's the bottom line, but feel free to let me know any of your thoughts. It's interesting to think about this notion of the audience as the formal cause, along with Walter Ong's notion of the writer's audience always being a fiction. The writer creates his audience, but the audience creates the writer. Again, we see formal cause as the interval between figure and ground. And maybe it's like the structure of a metaphor, with two figure-ground relationships in superposition. McLuhan says, quote, "Without the interplay of figure and ground, no art or knowledge is possible," unquote. This brings us back to the aforementioned memes. Talking about memes will, I think, really lay out why the interplay of figure and ground is necessary for art and knowledge, and I think, I hope, will deepen our understanding of formal cause. It follows nicely from the chair example, too. There's a great essay by Eric S. Jenkins, who talks about McLuhan's formal cause and how it relates to internet memes. Internet memes. I sound like an old person, but I want to stress we're going to focus on not just internet memes, but we're going to focus on simple memes for now, like the socially awkward penguin. I don't even know if people still do that one. Or like the muscular handshake where you write two things that agree or are working together onto the two hands that are shaking. I'm sure I don't have to explain internet memes to people. My favorite memes are the super surreal ones, right? Or the ones with like eight layers of irony and intertextuality. I'm sure many of the observations about simpler memes also relate to those, but involving those ones would make this a lot more confusing to talk about, obviously. So, Jenkins asks a question: how does a meme become a meme? Let's analyze this question using the four causes. The material cause is a bit tricky because, Aristotle didn't have cyberspace to contend with. So material cause maybe is just the pixels on the computer screen. Maybe it's like related to the image or like what the image is of. I don't know. Doesn't matter. It's the material. Whatever it is, it's not sufficient to answering the question of how a meme becomes a meme, right? What causes its coming into existence? We have efficient cause, but efficient cause just relates to the individuals that make individual iterations of the meme, or like, an individual seeing another person's meme and then having the idea to make their own meme. A meme propagates and comes into existence by a whole bunch of different little efficient causes. People seeing things, clicking things, typing things. And final cause similarly relates to each individual iteration of the meme, right? The goal being to make people laugh or something like that. Like there's no final cause for the meme in general. The meme kind of evolves, directionless, like an organism. But none of those three causes can really explain a meme in its entirety, right? Like, why do people share certain images, tweaking them to mean something slightly different each time, and not other ones? Like, how does a meme become a meme? How does a specific image become picked up and reworked slightly? Jenkins thinks we need formal cause to explain. Jenkins says that, quote, "Every new contributor, efficient cause, plays off the original photograph, material cause, in an attempt to be funny, final cause, but they can only do so because there is a shared, recognizable form that grounds their efforts," unquote. The form of the meme is the ground. Without it, no individual iterations of the meme could prosper. But that's not the whole story. The audience and creator must share a mode of seeing that's related to the form, but not synonymous with it. Jenkins says that reciprocality and resonance are necessary for a meme spread. Memes are reciprocal and resonant because they aren't owned or made by an individual. They spread like a virus, and their spread can be said to be based in resonance. Someone sees an image with a caption and then is like, ah, that's similar to my experience. Or is like, oh, I just thought of a joke that can relate to that image as well. And then they make their own meme, and this process occurs many, many times. It also resonates with the audience that shares particular iterations of it, right? The audience has to understand the form for the meme to work. Like, circulation is necessary for a meme, right? It's like the poem. If a meme was just, if somebody drew a socially awkward penguin in the desert somewhere, it's not a meme because it's, you know, nobody's sharing it, nobody's looking at it. I'm sure many of you have shown a meme to a grandparent or something and they're just confused because they're not used to it, they don't know how to interpret it, they aren't resonant with it. Another way to say this is they haven't learned that particular way of seeing. The maker of the meme must also know the form, obviously. The audience and creator must share this particular mode of seeing. This is another way that formal cause exists outside of time, if you remember back to last episode. This mode of seeing, this awareness of the form, is constantly in the background whenever an iteration of the meme is created or interpreted. In the background of both the maker and the audience. Formal cause can often blur the distinction between producer and consumer, something McLuhan thought was a consequence of the electronic age. This way of seeing is necessary for every iteration of the meme. It's always there as what Jenkins calls a virtual structuring device, necessary anytime someone makes or reads the meme. You can often use context clues, like I'm sure people can figure out what the muscular handshake meme means without prior experience with it. But I think there's still nuances of the form that are understood only after repeat exposure. And also, that isn't how memes work in general. In general, it's an automatic reading of it. And also, I'm sure memes build upon, you know, previous forms of media, previous modes of seeing. I'm sure if you showed it to somebody who had never experienced any of our previous technological environments, like, you know, some isolated person in the Sentinelese Islands, I'm sure they'd have a harder time intuitively understanding, like, the handshake, the muscular handshake meme. Plus, there are memes that are a lot harder to intuitively understand than the muscular handshake meme. Like the social awkward penguin, I mean, just for starters, that one's a little harder to understand. There's a less direct correlation between the awkward anecdote and the penguin, besides maybe the penguin's awkward stance. But once you get accustomed to it, you learn this way of seeing, where you see the penguin and you know what to expect. You're essentially asking a question like, ooh, how is this awkward? And obviously, this is a topic that fits better with the more complex memes, the neo-dadaist memes, the memes that contain 10 references and 8 necessary pieces of background knowledge. I'm sure you know about it. I'm sure you've seen the type. And, you know, those ones really require you to learn the way of seeing, right? Those are the ones my parents don't get, you know? Formal cause provides the ground, in other words, the form of the meme and the mode of seeing necessary for apprehending the meme. Without this ground, the meme would never circulate. The other three causes only make sense in terms of individual iterations of the meme, but not the meme in its entirety, in its circulation. Jenkins says, quote, "We can say that the mode of seeing is the logos of the form, its reciprocal counterpart necessary to make the form articulatable and understandable," unquote. Chairness, the thing that makes people look at a certain object and group it into the category of chair, is the logos of the form of the individual chair. It makes it articulatable and understandable. This is another area where we can play around with cause and effect, because this underlying chairness is a formal cause of the chair, but the end goal, the chair, the effect, is also chairness. It's chairness incarnate, chairness in the flesh. So in other words, the effect, the result, or at least a part of the effect, chairness, precedes the efficient, final, and material causes. Without chairness, nobody's gonna, you know, hammer and sand and saw and varnish in a particular manner to produce what we call a chair. Without chairness, nobody would have an idea to make a chair. Well, except the first person to ever make a chair, I guess. This makes more sense with less obvious inventions, I think. But just to round out the example, without chairness, no material would have the potential to become a chair, because there's no such thing yet. What's interesting about the meme example is that the mode of seeing necessary for particular memes can also be used in real life, when a situation occurs that's resonant with a given meme. Jenkins ends his essay arguing that memes are a way of structuring the flood of information that characterizes life, but especially the online experience. It's a way of making this flood comprehensible. It also acts as a way to group audiences. Many memes are only resonant with people of a specific milieu, or people who have certain politics, or people who have particular hobbies, or are involved in particular subcultures, that sort of thing. All right, so let's jump into what I promised a moment ago. A bit of contextualizing this in the history of Western philosophy. The chair example and McLuhan's understanding of formal cause in general relates to a deep question in philosophy, going back to the Greeks: the relationship between being, non-being, and becoming. Focusing on this question is called ontology, the study of being, and usually philosophers have answered the question by making some aspect of it primary, then making everything else rest upon it, or, you know, secondary to it. Plato had ideal forms that we can't see. This is the realm of being, whereas we see and experience non-ideal forms, forms that are related to these ideal forms, but instead are in our world, the world of becoming. Then Aristotle maintains the notion of ideal forms, but brings it down into the world we experience. In Aristotle, there's not a separate realm for these ideal forms. Instead, the ideal form is contained within substances as a potential to be actualized. The adult tree exists in the seed as a potential, the form of the adult tree. Aristotle divided the material world into substances and accidents, everything made up of both. Substance is the thing that defines the thing. The seed is substantially a tree or has tree-ness, whereas accidents are less primary aspects about the individual thing, like whether the seed is wet or dry, for example. Whether it's wet or dry doesn't affect its seedness or its tree-ness, its being. Substance is related to being, accident to becoming. This dichotomy of substance and accident continued for centuries after Aristotle, until the early modern era, when it was overtaken by the atomic understanding of modern science. This new understanding might still be described as a substantivist ontology, an ontology that treats substance or being as primary, because, well, first of all, atomism was first developed by the pre-Socratic philosophers, but mostly because a lot of Enlightenment and post-Enlightenment scientists still uphold substance as being the most important aspect of a given thing. Like seeing your genetic sequence as highly important, or seeing that apples are apples because they are made of specific molecules. These are the sort of things I'm talking about. These are some examples. This is all to say that substantivist ontologies, an understanding of reality where substance or being is primary, dominated Western philosophy for almost its entire history. But in the 20th century, a different ontology was developed more, one that sees relations or processes as primary. A seed isn't a seed primarily because of its seedness or tree-ness or its genetic code, its essence, its substance. There's no tree-ness or seedness. The primary thing is how a seed changes as it becomes a tree via various processes and interactions. What a tree is, primarily, is that trajectory from seed to tree to rotten log. These changes aren't happening to the tree. They are the tree, if that makes sense. And McLuhan can be somewhat placed within this trajectory, away from substantivism, since he's concerned with media as mediation, a form of relation. The meaning of meaning is relationship, as he says. But he's also somewhat substantivist, due to the influence of Aristotle and Thomas Aquinas, who built upon Aristotle himself. A medium or technological environment has a sort of essence that we can't truly apprehend. Only by the creation of anti-environments can we get close. So, in McLuhan's ontology, argues Yoni van den Eed, substance and relation both exist, and perhaps they themselves have an integral relationship, where substances can only be revealed via relation, but the substance is necessary for this revealing. Sorry if this is getting a little confusing. I hope that's somewhat easy to follow. And, you know, now would be a good time to talk about someone, a philosopher who is quite well known nowadays, called Graham Harman. He's a contemporary philosopher who developed something called object-oriented ontology, which also, like McLuhan, blends substance and relation. And he's been one of the few major contemporary philosophers to take McLuhan's tetrad seriously, going as far as to say it could be the starting point for a new metaphysics, which is quite the bold claim. And I found a short lecture from Harman from about 10 years ago on a small, not super active YouTube channel. So I figured I'd play it here. Not really sure about the rules about this sort of thing, but I can't see anybody being too angry. He's famous, and, you know, it's from 10 years ago. It's a talk titled McLuhan and Phenomenology. So I'm going to let him take it away for now, and I'll be back in 20 minutes.
His books include, and he has many, Tool Being, Heidegger and Metaphysics, and the Metaphysics of Objects, Prince of Networks, Bruno Latour and Metaphysics, and The Quadruple Object. And today Graham is going to be speaking on the topic of McLuhan and Phenomenology. Graham, please. Thank you.
Going to need to read this very quickly to fit it into 20 minutes, but I tend to read quickly anyway. McLuhan and Phenomenology is one of the most important themes I can think of for present-day philosophy, yet there are specific reasons why many people are not in a good position to see it now. Today I will speak about some of the obstacles to appreciating both McLuhan and Phenomenology in the early 21st century, and will also suggest that it is urgent that we circumvent these obstacles so as to put philosophy on a new track. To do so, it will be necessary to begin with some remarks on the state of contemporary philosophy. Following this, I will turn to my main theme roughly halfway through, McLuhan and Phenomenology. Our dominant contemporary philosopher is still Immanuel Kant, even though he's been dead for more than 200 years. What was most new in Kant, and what remains new even today, is the relation he emphasizes between depth and surface, the unknowable depth of the noumenal things in themselves, and the accessible phenomenal surface of the things for us. One of the major ways of responding to Kant has been to treat this problem repeatedly as a pseudo-problem. The things in themselves are ridiculed even by many of Kant's admirers, though this ongoing ridicule betrays the fact that everyone knows they must account for reality in some way under penalty of endorsing a full-blown idealism a la Berkeley of a sort that seems so extravagant that almost no one is willing to defend it. If Berkeley represents pure idealism and the things in themselves beyond human knowledge represent pure realism, the enterprise of much contemporary philosophy is to thread the needle in some way. The pony must be kept and also sold. We must go beyond the supposed pseudo-problem of realism and idealism. One common method of doing this is the correlationist method, so lucidly diagnosed in 2006 by Quentin Meyersou, and whose diagnosis provoked the counter-movement of speculative realism in its four basic forms. Correlationism refers to the claim that we cannot think of the world without humans, or humans without the world, but only of the primordial correlation or rapport between them. In short, correlationism agrees with Kant that we cannot know the things in themselves, but remain trapped within the human world correlate, while also denying that it's a trap at all. For even to speak of something outside the correlate is impossible, since we ourselves are doing the speaking, and therefore the human standpoint retains priority, even though so-called humanism is treated with contempt. The argument is a familiar one, and for some reason, and for some, it remains quite compelling. To think of the things in themselves outside thought is supposedly a performative contradiction, since in doing so, we claim to be thinking of the unthought. This is what Meyersou calls the correlationist circle. Now, Meyersou's remarks on ancestrality in the archifossil, in his book, of a reality pre-existing the emergence of thought by billions of years, are often misread as if they were meant as a scientific disproof of the human world correlate, but this is by no means the case. Meyersou accepts the argument of the correlationist circle against all dogmatic access to the things in themselves. Namely, we can't think the unthought without turning it into a thought. His appeal to ancestrality and the archifossil are simply meant to show that there is an inherent tension between correlationism and the claims of natural science. And from ASU, this tension must be addressed not simply by asserting that science proves realism, but by doing justice to science from within the correlationist circle that Maesu himself accepts. Elsewhere, I have tried to show several reasons why Maesu's solution fails. He argues only that mathematics allows us to discover the primary of quality things that can exist, even if no human thought has yet emerged, and even if all human thoughts is someday exterminated. In other words, it is merely a temporal in itself that can outlast the human lifespan. But insofar as humans in the world both exist currently, there is no in itself beyond the access of thought, for Maesu. We can know the world directly via the tools of mathematics and the Galilean natural sciences that mathematics makes possible. Whereas Maesu accepts the correlationist circle at the start and seeks a complicated argument to escape it, I hold that he never does escape it, since he ends up with a model in which the world is thoroughly penetrable in principle by mathematical tools. Given his inability to account for the fact that knowledge of the real is always a translation and hence a distortion or transformation of the real, Maesu, like the correlationist he criticizes so severely, is in fact an idealist rather than a realist. Another attempt to sidestep the problem of reality can be found in recent philosophies of Hegelian inspiration, such as that of Slavoj Žižek, who is obviously well-known here at Birkbeck. For Žižek, who draws on Lacanian psychoanalysis at least as much as Hegelian philosophy, the difference between subject and object is itself generated only by the subject and its difference from itself in its encounter with the inassimilable traumatic real kernel at the heart of subjective experience. Žižek's philosophical position is every bit as sophisticated as Maesu's, but it ultimately derives from the same acceptance of the correlationist circle, with its claim that to think of an in itself outside thought is to fall into a performative or pragmatic contradiction. As Žižek and co-author Marcus Gabriel put it in their 2009 book, Mythology, Madness, and Laughter, German idealism was designed to effectuate a shift from epistemology to a new ontology without simply regressing to a pre-critical metaphysics. But this is a misunderstanding of how pre-critical or pre-Kantian metaphysics did its work. The problem with pre-critical dogmatic metaphysics was its insistence on the direct knowability of things in themselves, such that it offered rational proofs of the finitude or infinity of time and space, the existence or non-existence of God, a smallest particle of matter, or free will. Kant's answer to such dogmatic metaphysics was to insist on a gap between the inherent reality of such things and any access to them. For this reason, there is no performative contradiction at work when Kant holds that there are things in themselves that can be thought but not known, any more than it is a performative contradiction to refer to Prime Minister Cameron by name without being able to specify in exhaustive manner the exact features and motivations of his character. Kant's critique of dogmatism is a critique of the accessibility of the real, not of the existence of it. And the fact that in speaking of the real we are speaking of it does not entail that it cannot be real apart from our speaking. For this reason, it is Maesu and Žižek who are the true heirs of dogmatism. I leave out Marcus Gabriel, who has distanced himself somewhat from the claims made in the 2009 book, given their view that we can access the real directly. In fact, the only way to avoid dogmatism is to follow Kant in insisting on a gap between the real and any access to it. Kant's mistake lay not in endorsing finitude, but in making it a special tragic property of human beings, so that only rational beings were haunted by the inaccessibility of the in itself, when the same must hold true of animals, wheat, and colliding stones. In all of these cases, the real is not fully translatable into any relation to the real. This is the central principle of object-oriented philosophy, which might have been defended 2 centuries earlier if Kant had been abandoned in favor of a German realism rather than a German idealism. For further discussion of this point, I'll refer you to my books, since there's other topics now to cover. I'll make one other point about Maesu and Žižek, who are full-blown idealists, despite their denial of it, and despite Žižek's misunderstanding of Maesu as a sort of dangerous pre-critical realist. It is not accidental that both thinkers call themselves materialists, since materialism is simply idealism with an alibi. As Bruno Latour has nicely noted in a brilliant article that amazingly has only been cited 24 times in its 6 years of existence, despite Latour's international fame. And that's, can we get our materialism back, please, if you don't know that article. Latour's point in this article, which I endorse completely, is that materialism in no way exhausts the real, but simply reduces entities to some particular inadequate model of what they are, whether it be mass, spatiotemporal location, resistance, or in Maesu's case, mathematizability. By reducing the thing to its formalizability in material terms, material in scare quotes, we deny the inherent mystery and surprise of things and make them isomorphic with our knowledge of them under ideal intellectual conditions. So, materialism is always a kind of idealism, and that is why I have called for realism without materialism, or Kant without the human privilege, rather than Kant without the limitations on knowledge, which is what Maesu and Žižek recommend. Despite the great prestige of materialism on the political left as a tool for annihilating sorcerers, churches, witch doctors, capitalism, and tooth fairies, we must not forget that materialism is philosophically flawed. Rather than being the opposite to idealism, as the Marxist tradition still claims, materialism is perhaps the very incarnation of it. That brings us to McLuhan and phenomenology, who perhaps surprisingly offer us a way out of idealism in both its materialist and non-materialist variants. My thesis concerning McLuhan and phenomenology is simple. Namely, both can be described as media theory, but in a surprising twofold sense that reflects the ambivalence of media themselves. Namely, in a first sense, media are that which hide in the background behind any content, providing the invisible conditions for the visibility of that content. We find this idea everywhere in McLuhan, Marshall McLuhan, but most famously in his slogan that the medium is the message. But we also find this idea in Heidegger, the former crown prince of phenomenology, with his notion that being, or that which withdraws, is always more profound than the legible surface of presence at hand or the stockpiling work of technology. But in a second sense, media are not what withdraws behind all content, but that which enables the very transmission of content. While less conspicuous in McLuhan's work, this idea is no less pivotal for his thinking than the saying that the medium is the message. And this is the idea that we surprisingly find in the philosophy of Edmund Husserl, the founder of phenomenology in 1900. To state this duality in terms of Kantian philosophy, in one sense media theory is about the noumenal background to any explicit content, while in another sense media theory is about the phenomenal space through which all hidden backgrounds communicate. Both senses of mediation are crucial for present-day philosophy, and both require that we abandon the idealism and materialism that dominate the scene at the moment. For this reason, to defend McLuhan is to ask for a new turn in philosophy. McLuhan's basic idea is stated and repeated clearly throughout his breakthrough book of 1964, Understanding Media. The medium is the message, which is to say that the content of any medium is always another medium. For example, the railway accelerated and enlarged the scale of previous human functions, creating totally new kinds of cities and new kinds of work and leisure. This happened whether the railway functioned in a tropical or northern environment and is quite independent of the freight or content of the railway medium. And likewise, whether the electric light is being used for brain surgery or night baseball is a matter of indifference, according to McLuhan. To say that the medium is the message is to say that the surface content of any medium is trivial compared with the changes wrought by the unnoticed background conditions of that medium. McLuhan expands on that point 10 pages later. Our conventional response to all media, namely that it is how they are used that counts, is the numb stance of the technological idiot. For the content of a medium is like the juicy piece of meat carried by the burglar to distract the watchdog of the mind. The effects of technology do not occur at the level of opinions or concepts, but alter sense ratios or patterns of perception steadily and without any resistance. For anyone familiar with recent philosophy, there is an obvious parallel with Heidegger. Heidegger, too, is a theorist of the depths rather than the surface. Whereas phenomenology tries to suspend all judgment about the world outside conscious accessibility, Heidegger notes that conscious awareness is a relatively rare case. His question of being, as opposed to the question of beings, which on the one hand has to do with unity over against plurality, but more importantly refers to the veiled or concealed character of being over against the manifest presence of beings. For both McLuhan and Heidegger, the deep background conditions of a situation are everything, and the surface content of perception is merely derivative. This might seem to lead to a passive attitude on the part of humans, in politics as elsewhere. Heidegger of the later period is often accused, understandably enough, of advocating that we merely wait for the next great epoch of being to send itself rather than engaging in overt political activity. Analogously, McLuhan is often accused of being a technological determinist who sees all deliberate human action as a frivolous playing with content silently dominated by the background media in play at any given moment. Both McLuhan and Heidegger seem to have such allegiance to the depths of the world that they excessively downplay the surface where human decisions unfold. Yet this is not entirely true. In Heidegger's case, for example, being needs human being as its shepherd, allowing it to come to presence in different historical forms. And more than this, for reasons I can't argue in detail this morning, since entities withdraw absolutely from each other, they can only make contact with surfaces or caricatures of each other. The same holds for McLuhan. Media in themselves, for McLuhan, are so deep that if they were truly beyond all earthly attempts to change them, each medium would remain permanently in force, and the very history of media that McLuhan describes would be impossible. There are actually two ways McLuhan thinks media can change. The first is through the role of artists in the widest sense, in what the later McLuhan calls retrieval. We humans are not helpless as long as there are artists in our midst, for as McLuhan puts it, the serious artist is the only person able to experience technology with impunity, just because the serious artist is an expert aware of the changes in sense perception. Whereas most of us, most of the time, are simply hypnotized by the background effects of technology, the serious artist from McLuhan is able to create an anti-environment that makes the medium itself visible and thereby counter its dangers. The artist can take dead cliches and bring them back to life as active media, which is precisely what retrieval means for McLuhan. If normally the medium is the message, the artist converts message into a new medium. In this way, the supposedly worthless sensual content of the world becomes the gateway to a change in the media themselves. And there's also a second way for McLuhan that the content leads to changes in the ground, one that does not rely on the intermittent genius of serious artists. This is what he calls the reversal of the overheated medium. For McLuhan, cold media are those such as television that lack an explicit detail and thus have the hypnotic effect of provoking involvement by the viewer. Despite the paradoxical term cold, even fire would count as a cold medium, given its vague and flickering form, so conducive to the mesmerization of humans seated near fireplaces. By contrast, hot media are those such as radio that provide total explicit information. Yet McLuhan's tendency to classify certain types of media as inherently hot or cold is countered by an opposite tendency in his books to treat the heat of a given medium as variable, so that it can increase over time. This is how reversal occurs. While email begins as a convenient labor-saving device that eliminates countless trips to the post office, its numerical increase in instant delivery via smartphone means that we are now constantly at the post office, sending and receiving letters. Notice that reversal, just like the serious artist's retrieval, is a matter of the surface. For nothing in the medium structure of email itself entails reversal. Instead, it is email's interaction with other media, such as smartphones or job duties redefined with the expectation of quick response times, that lead email to reverse from a convenience into a crushing burden that we often wish would disappear into the past. If media are deep and unnoticed, media are unable to change or even to interact with us and with each other without the interface of a surface, McLuhan's despised surface of content. No less than Heidegger, McLuhan fails in his efforts to be a thinker exclusively of the depths and has to become a theorist of how the surface manipulates the depth. And this brings us to the other side of the medium. The medium is interface rather than its hidden background condition. We've seen how McLuhan relies on retrieval and reversal as the engine of human history, and thus becomes a champion of decision and accident rather than deep technological determinism. We even saw that Heidegger is forced into the same predicament despite his contempt for visible beings in the plural as ontic, his term of contempt. But the care for the surface is even more evident in the phenomenologist whom Heidegger tried to turn upside down, his teacher Edmund Husserl. For Husserl, there is no question of an inaccessible world lying beyond all possible access, an idea he regards as nonsense. Although Husserl's philosophical motto was to the things themselves, he did not mean Kant's hidden things in themselves, but only the things themselves lying before us already, intentional objects, or as I call them, sensual objects. If they are lying before us already, you might ask, then what is the use of difficult technical philosophy? But this point is the key to Husserl, for unlike the empiricists who took unified objects to be nothing more than nicknames for a series of different appearances to the mind, so that the supposedly same apple at times T1, T2, and T3 would be only closely related through their family resemblances, Husserl discovered a remarkable world of objects that do not lie deeper than consciousness, but do lie deeper than the details they present to us at any given moment, deeper than the Abschattungen or adumbrations through which they are visible to us, hence the need for the technical apparatus of philosophy. For as Husserl sees it, it is somewhat difficult to determine the essential features of a specific apple that endure through all the shifting perceptions and experiences we have of it. Along with Heidegger's real apple that withdraws more deeply than any encounter with it, there is Husserl's sensual apple that does not withdraw from the mind, since it is always there, but is still easily confused with its shifting accidental properties. What Husserl calls the eidetic reduction is a method for removing these accidental features of the sensual apple and getting direct intuition into its essence, a project that, in my opinion, inevitably fails, just as I hold that Mayasu's and Zizek's direct access to reality fails. Although Husserl is often bizarrely linked with Kant, what is missing in Husserl, though present in Heidegger, is the Kantian insight into the permanent rift between the things in themselves and any matter of accessibility. Although media theory might be viewed as having only a peripheral interest for philosophy, communication should be seen as the central problem of modern philosophy. Indeed, I've often written about this theme. For theological reasons, some of the early Arab thinkers held that God was the only possible causal medium. When fire seems to burn cotton, it is actually God who burns cotton. The proximity of fire to cotton only provides the occasion for God himself to burn cotton. Although this is easily ridiculed in the post-Enlightenment West, the topic is still taken seriously when it becomes the mind-body problem of Descartes, who also appeals to God, whether sincerely or not, as the medium of communication between the two different kinds of finite substance, mind and body. And it is taken even more seriously when not God, but the human mind is treated as the universal ether of communication between any two distinct entities, as when David Hume treats causation as customary conjunction or habit of the mind, or when Immanuel Kant treats causation as a structure internal to finite human experience. Yet Kant already oversteps these bounds, as his critics noted very early, when he treats causation not just as an internal structure of phenomenal experience, but as the very link between things in themselves and the appearances, as when he says that there cannot be appearances without things that appear, which cause the appearances. Although obviously a contradiction, it is a fruitful one. Contradiction is often the wage we pay to a reality that exceeds the grasp of our theories. The problem with occasionalist theories, as they're called, is not that they made God the causal medium, which the standard atheism of 21st century Western intellectual life requires us to mock, the philosophical problem with occasionalism is not that God was God, but that God was one specific entity allowed to solve a causal problem that arises as soon as we see that entities are deeper than any possible relation to them. Fire cannot touch cotton directly, not because a particular interpretation of the Quran would forbid it, but because no entity can be given unexplained magic communicative powers that are denied to all other entities. But the same goes for the human mind, as in Immanuel Kant, which simply posits the mind as a causal glue while failing to address what happens when object touches object in the absence of any human mind. The gap between non-communicating objects must be bridged in such a way that it can happen anywhere, though with some difficulty, not by appealing to a divine or human king to solve the problem by fiat once and for all. Last paragraph. In one sense, McLuhan joins Heidegger in treating the medium as a background deeper than any possible content, any possible surface manifestation. For McLuhan, the deep structure of the television medium withdraws deeper than the content of any television program, while for Heidegger, the hammer is deeper than any hammer effects until it breaks and comes to our view. But in another sense, McLuhan joins Husserl in seeing the surface of the world as the place where an entity exists in tension with its own shifting accidental properties. Is the medium an inaccessible deep structure, or is it a surface of communication where one thing easily touches another? Which model is correct? The answer is that both must be equally correct in order for the world to function as it does. There is a world in itself, just as Kant says, given that no access to a thing ever gives us the thing in itself, but inevitably translates or distorts it. Yet there is also a sensual world, a world of images and simulacra, that cannot be eliminated in favor of its causal underpinnings. Just as the link between the real medium postal mail and the real medium email is the supposedly superficial realm of surface content, the link between two images is the real medium that I am in each case myself, and that each object is in each case. Two real objects are mediated by the sensual, and two sensual objects are mediated by the real, just as only the opposite poles of magnets can touch without repulsion. The medium is the message, and the message is in turn the medium. Whereas idealism and its bastard child materialism simply eliminate the problem of communication by calling it a pseudo-problem, realism without materialism recognizes communication as the central problem of contemporary philosophy. Thank you.
So Graham Harman's theory, known as object-oriented ontology, builds upon a dichotomy of Heidegger's, modifying it and extending it beyond the human realm, making it applicable to all objects and concepts and, you know, probably some other stuff. Harman sees many similarities between McLuhan and Heidegger. For example, McLuhan's notion of visual culture is similar to Heidegger's critique of something he calls presence at hand, and the figure-ground interplay is similar to the dichotomy in Heidegger that Harman takes up. This dichotomy also involves substance and relation, not one or the other, albeit using weird Heideggerian language that I'm not going to get into here, because I don't know about it. Instead of saying substance versus relation, it's probably better to call it concealing versus revealing, since Harman believes that the substance of an object cannot be grasped by us. Its being is concealed. We can only access it through relation, what it reveals. And I apologize if I'm misinterpreting this. I haven't read super deeply into this. McLuhan has many passages that resonate with this notion. But the key thing, I think, is that Harman borrows another dichotomy from the philosopher Husserl to try to get at figuring out how objects interact with other objects, since the real object cannot relate, that like hidden aspect of it, its being. This dichotomy from Husserl is one of object versus qualities. There's this really cool part of Husserl that really made me think when I first learned about it. The idea that you can never see an object in its entirety at once. It's one of those things that's like really obvious, but it's so obvious that you never really think about it. His example is a house. Whenever you look at a house, you only see one side of it, or you're only, if you're inside, you only see a part of one room. You can never apprehend the whole thing at once. You can, of course, walk around the house, go inside the house, go on top of the house, and see it from every possible angle, but like, as you do that, the day changes, you know, there's changes going on. You can never see all of it at one instant. I think he said something like, the definition of a house is every possible perception of the house, or every possible viewpoint or something. What's really interesting though, is that there's all these different ways of apprehending a house, but every time we see it as a house. Harman's second dichotomy is the object versus qualities. So in this example, the object being the house and its qualities depending on viewpoint and perceiver. With these two dichotomies, concealing versus revealing, and object versus qualities, Harmon develops a four-piece ontological structure of every object. He says that all objects have a real object with real qualities, the concealed part, and the sensual object with sensual qualities, the revealed part. And of course, I'm sure I don't have to tell you that this four-part structure, you know, you can probably think about it, how it relates to the four-part tetrad. Harmon says that the McLuhans' grand thoughts, they're boasting about the tetrad, that it's the biggest intellectual discovery of our time, is too modest. This is because, like other McLuhan scholars, he thinks that the laws aren't limited to human-made objects, but instead they can be applied to all objects. He horizontally broadens the scope of their insight, I guess. Harmon says that the main division in ontology is not humans versus objects, but the inner core or substance of objects and their relations or accidents. These inner cores can only be gleaned through translation. Related to Harmon is the work of Bruno Latour, who argues that we should see objects as having the ability to act, not just humans and other conscious beings. Latour argues that any relationality involves translation or mediation. His ontology really highlights translation and form, two things that McLuhan also highlighted. Latour argues that form is primary, like the main thing, and does away with the classical dichotomy of matter and form that many in the history of Western philosophy are concerned with. And this allows formal and final cause to reemerge. Again, all this is according to Yoni van den Eed. I have not read much Latour. Latour does away with substance, which Harmon thinks is a mistake, arguing that both substance and relation exist. There's a part of every object that doesn't interact, and it's necessary. Harmon says, quote, "Unless the thing holds something in reserve behind its current relations, nothing would ever change," unquote. That's a quote I'm going to have to think about more. Substance or being is always there, lurking, unable to be directly apprehended, buttressing the relational becoming of an object. Harmon likens this to McLuhan's notion of ground. Yoni van den Eed argues that McLuhan's notion of the interval is something that can be related to this notion of the inaccessible part of an object. But I think I've gone on about this long enough. You could talk about this forever. Harmon's written some more about him, about McLuhan, if you're interested. I want to finish this episode by talking about another take on McLuhan's formal causality. Something really cool that I mentioned already is that McLuhan predicted that formal cause would become more prominent with electronic technology. More and more, like, regular, average people, not just artists, will start to recognize it, start to think using it, I guess. And guess what? In the decade following McLuhan's death, new related forms of inquiry emerged, and these can be connected to McLuhan's version of formal cause. These fields are called complexity theory and emergent dynamics, and, you know, I think there's other similar notions in this whole nexus. Emergence is a promising way of analyzing media effects while avoiding technological determinism. Unfortunately, this language developed after McLuhan's death, so he couldn't make use of it. He had to do the weird thing of retrieving a concept from antiquity and trying to match it up with the current situation, the current technological and intellectual environment. Some McLuhan scholars say that McLuhan's formal cause prefigures emergence, or that it was McLuhan's way of talking about similar things. Robert Logan goes as far as saying that McLuhan's notion of formal cause is more closely related to emergence than to Aristotle's notion of formal cause. But before we start talking about that, let's go over what emergence is. We talked about this a little bit last episode when talking about the climate change and the Syrian civil war. It's essentially the idea that there can be systems, called emergent systems, that have properties that can't be predicted from or derived from the properties of all the parts of the system. Like, just by looking at one neuron, you can't predict the properties of a brain, a bunch of neurons. Or by looking at just one molecule of frozen water, you can't predict the symmetrical patterns of snowflakes. Emergence is often split into weak and strong emergence, where only in strong emergence can the properties of a system not be reduced to its parts. Weak emergence can be found in Aristotle when he says stuff like the whole is greater than the sum of its parts, but he and other philosophers didn't talk about reducibility. Only recently has that concept caught on. This is a big reason Logan thinks McLuhan's notion of formal cause is closer to emergence. Aristotle seems to have thought that the properties of a system would have to be reducible to its parts, or its prior form. For example, Aristotle's understanding of how biological organisms grew, from their first stage to their adult stage, gets close to emergence, but he maintains that the adult form is present in the organism at the beginning, rather than being something new that emerges out of growth and all the actions and life of the organism. All these questions are super interesting, like when is something new, rather than just being a molded version of something old or multiple things in a certain arrangement? There's all these really cool, deep questions here. And of course, let me know if you have any relevant texts to recommend. Aristotle's understanding of cause presumes an agent, Logan argues, and his formal cause is tied up with intentionality, whereas emergence is something that doesn't need an agent. The form that emerges usually can't even be predicted, and there's not necessarily a purpose beforehand, since a lot of emergence happens naturally or unconsciously. Strong emergence also doesn't accord with final cause or efficient cause, since the emerged form is not due to some purposeful agent. A lot of this has to do with the cosmology of ancient Greece, as I mentioned, which included like deities and stuff. Nature was much more agential to them, as well as many other cultures today. This is why Logan thinks that the McLuhans were wrong for saying that the Tetrad and their notion of formal cause only applies to the human and human artifacts. Logan thinks it can be easily extended. But all this isn't to say that McLuhan came up with this way of thinking completely on his own. General systems theory in the 50s was an early precursor to complexity theory and emergence, where wholes in nature began to be thought of as important, rather than just trying to, you know, understand the whole by splitting it into parts, known as reductionism. Cybernetics too, arising in the same time frame, was another precursor. There were earlier precursors in biology in the 1800s, but these were overshadowed by the discovery of genetics, which of course made scientists want to reduce things down to genetics. In McLuhan's letters, it's shown that he had read some of the general systems theorists in the 50s. Emergence reemerged, funny way of saying it, emergence reemerged after McLuhan's death, related to new mathematical tools like chaos theory and dynamical systems theory, and, you know, as well as advanced computer modeling. Logan says that before the language and this focus on emergence and complexity theory, complex nonlinear systems were thought to be the exception in nature, whereas now they're seen as more the rule. Logan says that Aristotle's causality is outdated when it comes to our current scientific and philosophical understanding of the world, but McLuhan retrieved formal causality. And of course, retrieval entails adapting the retrieved thing to the current environment. McLuhan adapts formal cause by talking about cause and effect reversing, effects preceding causes, and, relatedly, the reversing of figure and ground. Logan says that McLuhan makes Aristotle's causality less linear and prefigures emergence theory. He says that McLuhan's retrieval of formal cause is more like strong emergence than Aristotle's formal cause. So let's get more specific about the similarities. McLuhan's analysis of certain technologies, like writing, the alphabet, the printing press, and electronic technology, shows how drastically they changed the total media environment. This is similar to the notion of phase transitions in emergent systems, the idea that certain changes within or to a system can lead to that system exhibiting dramatically different properties. The phase transitions related to states of matter is the classic example, like how water at 5 degrees Celsius acts pretty similar to water at 15 degrees Celsius, but water at negative 5 degrees has wildly different properties. It's all hard and stuff. This is similar to how McLuhan would say that the technological environment of 13th century France is fairly similar to 13th century Germany, even though they speak a different language. But the invention of the printing press dramatically changes both of these nations. It's like a phase transition. It's like water turning to ice. Both McLuhan and complexity theorists think that new properties of a system can arise at certain points that can't be reduced or predicted from the lower levels they emerge from. Media environments are self-organizing systems to McLuhan. The environment's form influences the information tied to it, and then people receive that information with that certain influence, and then propagate that influence with what they do with that information or how they organize their thoughts about it. This is another reason Logan thinks that Aristotle's four causes don't really capture what McLuhan was on about, since in self-organizing systems, the efficient cause, formal cause, and final cause kind of collapse into one thing. Since the system creates itself in a way, it's its own efficient cause, I guess. And this creation is due to its own pattern of organization, its form, formal cause. So formal and efficient cause are the same thing. And the only purpose the system has is to continue existing, propagating its form. So its final cause can be said to be the same thing as its formal cause. In other words, Aristotle's four causes, Logan is skeptical about how useful they are, and says that if McLuhan had lived 10 years longer, he probably would have just used the language of emergence. McLuhan went even further than complexity theory, though, with his rearview mirror idea, saying that a lot of people can't even detect the effects that emerge from the new environment until a newer environment supersedes it. McLuhan understood media to be non-linear, open-ended, and environmental. Media, its content, and its senders and receivers interact in a non-linear and complex way, since McLuhan believes that the form of a given media affects the content and people involved on a large scale. Media ecologists like McLuhan criticized the Shannon Weaver model of communication, what I think is the most famous model of communication, since it splits content from form and, in the McLuhan's view, neutralizes the effects of the medium of communication and the environmental ground, how technologies and symbols and contexts interact with each other, things like that. In other words, the media sphere is kind of like the biosphere, evolving without a plan, evolving due to the selection and constraint on all the complex interactions of its various parts, growing more complex, so far at least, and constantly unfolding. We can also take concepts from the biosphere and use them as analogies when talking about the media sphere. So for example, there's something called niche construction in biology, and it's something we all have examples of. It's just when an organism alters its own local environment, like a beaver damming a river, right? It changes the local environment quite a bit. It goes from a flowing river to a like a pond or a lake. But even though we all know examples of niche construction, we still don't really seem to think too much about how it complicates our high school biology understanding of evolution, right? Because that understanding of evolution says that organisms adapt to their own environment. But that kind of ignores how organisms can change their environment, right? It's almost like there's an interplay between the ground, the environment, and the figure of the organism. And it obviously complicates cause and effect, too. And we can take this concept of niche construction out of biology and, you know, see if it works with McLuhan's technological environments, too. Like, a new technology needs to find a space in the existing environment, so it pushes another form of technology out, what McLuhan called obsolescence. This weird thing happens that McLuhan talks about a lot, where the new technology is understood in terms of the old technology, like how cars were called horseless carriages when they were first invented. They were very similar to horse-drawn carriages, but better in certain ways, which meant that they overtook horse-drawn carriages and prominence became more popular. But by doing this, they changed the environment quite dramatically, like completely altering the structure of cities and creating highways, which then changed our relationship to the land and to the countryside. The interplay between figure and ground never ends and can lead to properties that are emergent. McLuhan is focused on media, but Lance Strait, another McLuhan scholar who thinks McLuhan's thinking can be extended beyond human artifacts, says, quote, "I think it reasonable to extend it to scientific explanation and ask, in what sense is evolution reducible to efficient cause, given that it involves a process of natural selection in which environmental constraints provide a source of negative feedback influencing the natural course of reproduction and mutation," unquote. That might be a little bit of a mouthful, but constraints seem to be a big part of formal cause and emergence. If an environment makes it impossible or harder for an organism to do something, that plays a part in the cause of whatever the organism does do, right? The structure of our environment often nudges us in certain ways, and we don't really think about this, but if you imagine these nudges on a large scale, you can imagine that they would produce large-scale effects, right? Maybe a new medium doesn't introduce anything new into society, just encourages already existing things and discourages others. Lance Strait says, quote, "We return here to the idea of constraints. In this case, the idea that the environment provides constraints within which organisms, species, and evolution itself must adjust themselves, being also capable of altering their environment in turn." Along the same lines, grammar provides certain constraints and limitations on language that are essential to its functioning, and it follows that the concepts of grammar, structure, relationships, media, and environments have much in common, and within the field of media ecology, can be seen as synonymous. Unquote. I really like thinking about all these concepts in biology and evolutionary theory that go beyond the sort of basic high school biology understanding of it. I'll put a link in the show notes to a really cool interview that I enjoyed about this, if you want to learn more. And maybe by looking at biology, we can get an idea of what McLuhan means when he says effects precede causes. In biology, there's a thing called pre-adaptation or exaptation. For example, insect wings are thought to have been originally developed evolutionarily for cooling the animal before being adapted for flight. Or swim bladders in fish, used by the fish to control how easily they float or sink, so making it easier to swim at a given depth. These are thought to have evolved into lungs for land-based animals. So in other words, something evolves for one reason, but then gets used for a different purpose, and then that becomes the main use of it, driving evolution in that direction. Like for example, as insect wings develop further, now you have butterfly wings and dragonfly wings, all these different types of wings for flying. These are kind of effects preceding causes in a certain way. I wonder if this can be connected at all to Eric McLuhan mentioning the increase in optical experiments in the early 15th century that paved the way for linear perspective in the printing press. I feel intuitively that there's a similarity there. Quote, "Most of the effects of any medium or innovation occur before the arrival of the innovation itself. A vortex of these effects tends in time to become the innovation." Unquote. Robert Logan says, quote, "There's no simple linear cause and effect relationship in the emergence of an emergent system, as the components that make up the emergent system exert an upward effect on the composite system, the parts creating the whole, and vice versa, the composite system exerts downward effects on its components, which form constraints on the behavior of those components. The interactions of the components that lead to the self-organization of the emergent system are non-linear because of that upward and downward causation. The lateral non-linear causation of the components of the system among themselves actually creates the emergent system. The emergent system then in turn acts downward on those components of which it is composed." Unquote. It's really complicated, but it's really cool to think about. All right, so I hope all of that was a good intro to the notion of formal cause and McLuhan's unique interpretation of it. To end, let's look at how it relates to time, and then talk about Lance Strait's tetrad he wrote with formal cause as the subject. Three of Aristotle's causes can be placed in a temporal sequence. The material cause must be existing before the efficient cause, since the efficient cause is something that acts upon the material to change it. And it is changing it into a final form, or to have some future effect. So we can say that the material cause exists in the past, the efficient cause exists in the present, and the final cause exists in the future. Where does formal cause exist then? Eric McLuhan says it exists out of time, but Lance Strait criticizes this, saying that it's more in line with Plato's notion of forms than with our contemporary understanding of reality. He says that maybe formal cause is more like time itself, since Aristotle's metaphysics was very much based on change and dynamism, which is related to time because time is just a way of talking about change, right? If nothing changed in the universe, there would be no time. Rather than existing outside of time, in that same realm as eternal forms, formal cause exists as time, providing the ground for the other three causes, Since permanence is associated with writing and dynamism with speech, Strait suggests that the audio tactility of electronic media is a factor in the retrieval of formal cause, and sees an analogy with Einstein's relativity, how the three spatial dimensions are unified across the fourth dimension of time, and how the three causes are synthesized across the fourth cause, formal cause. Lance Strait wrote a tetrad of McLuhan's notion of formal causality and McLuhan's tetrad, which are kind of the same thing. So, Lance Strait says that McLuhan's notion of formal causality, quote, enhances media ecology, obsolesces content analysis, retrieves Einstein's four-dimensional space-time continuum, and flips it into the reversal of cause and effect, unquote. On the episode with a passage of Mackenzie Works, a contemporary media theorist, from her book Sensoria, which I recommend is a great way to learn about some contemporary thinkers that most of them aren't super well known. Works says, quote, one cannot make causal statements about the media any more than one can about the weather. Neither works like a gun or a hypodermic. Media, like weather, may have material, agential, and formal causes, but not final causes. They don't tend toward a goal, and it may help to think more about formal causes than agents or materials. This was McLuhan's innovation, to think of media as not being about objects or subjects, but forms that shape both. The form of a given media shapes how things can appear to us, and what kind of subjects we can be in regarding them. Unquote. All right, so one more episode, maybe two, about art, and then we'll be done with McLuhan. I'll see you next time.